Chapter 5. From Hero Worship to the Worshipping Buddha. If the Buddha is by his very nature a hero, and if the Buddhist ideal is a heroic ideal, where does this leave us? How does the heroic ideal relate to us, or how do we relate to it? What is the difference between one who is a hero and one who is not a hero? Is there an essential difference between them? It might help to answer this if we bring in another term here, if we say that the hero is also the genius, the cultural hero. So where does the difference between the genius and the ordinary person lie? The way we use the term genius tends to suggest that the difference is one of kind, that the genius is somehow a different species. But in fact, the difference is simply one of degree. It is as though what is undeveloped or hardly developed in ourselves is highly developed or fully developed in someone we call a genius. Take music, for instance, which is a series of sounds organized in such a meaningful pattern as to be beautiful. Clearly, anyone who is not deaf has in some degree the capacity to appreciate it. Dr. Johnson used to confess, or rather, more characteristically, used to pride himself on the fact that he was unable to recognize the tune to God Save the King. It is questionable, however, whether the musical faculty can really be totally missing from a person's makeup. In the case of a great musician, that faculty is simply, by virtue of an innate or developed predilection, sheer application, parental encouragement, natural talent, and force of character, converted into what we call genius. The same goes for literature. A great poet or novelist uses the same mode of expression as we do when we write a letter, only they take their use of language to the highest possible pitch of expressiveness. And it is said that the most wretchedly painted signboard of a village inn shows that a Rembrandt once lived in the world. This principle may be applied to almost any subject. Some people are good philosophers, and others are poor philosophers, but no one can be said to be without a philosophy at all. A great philosopher simply philosophizes with greater rigor and imagination than the rest of us. If the difference between the genius and the ordinary person were not a matter simply of degree, but in some sense of kind, we should be unable to appreciate the productions of genius. We can appreciate the music, or the poetry, or the philosophy, only because there is music and poetry and philosophy already in us. We have an affinity, however undeveloped, for these things. One of the medieval German mystics in a poem compares the affinity of the eye with the sun to the affinity of the human soul with God. Just as the eye could not behold the sun unless the eye had in it something that was like the sun, he says, so the human soul could not perceive the divinity unless in the human soul there was something of the divine. So we cannot appreciate Mozart unless there is something of Mozart in us. We cannot appreciate Shakespeare unless there is something of Shakespeare in us. And, as we shall see, we cannot appreciate the Buddha unless there is something of the Buddha in us. Such appreciation does not come easily, of course. We may be stretched and challenged to our limits by the output of a creative artist. Indeed, it may be beyond us altogether to appreciate their work. Even in the case of Mozart, who is not commonly regarded as a revolutionary, some of his contemporaries thought they detected in his later works mistakes of harmony, whereas in fact he had simply moved beyond the conventions of the time. He had outstripped the general level of sensibility. To begin with, the creative genius is on his or her own, but then gradually more and more individuals catch up with their vision until eventually there is a general raising of cultural sensibility. Almost anyone becomes able, with a little effort, to appreciate the work of great individuals of the past. A corresponding process takes place in the opposite direction. The general level of cultural achievement provides the raw materials with which the exceptional individual expresses his or her genius. It is no coincidence that Mozart grew up in an intensely musical society, or that Michelangelo appeared at the height of the Italian Renaissance, or that Shakespeare honed his skills amidst a galaxy of dramatic poets, or that Plato cogitated within a city humming with philosophical inquiry. The same must go for the originators of spiritual and religious traditions. They are the product, in some degree, of favourable cultural milieu, and it is no surprise to find that the Buddha appeared at a time of intense spiritual inquiry. Cultural development, however, takes place largely through the efforts of individuals working on their own, or in contact with a few friends. Groups, schools, and institutions tend to stifle creativity. In terms of cultural evolution, then, the genius or the hero is the forerunner, a few steps ahead of the rest of humanity, but leading the way for others to follow. This brings us back to our evolutionary model of human development. On the one hand, we have the Buddhist model of spiritual development, and on the other, we have the scientific model of evolution. As we have seen, the two models may, from a Buddhist viewpoint at least, be put together, so that the Buddhist vision can be seen as, in some sense, developing on from the scientific vision to produce one continuous process of development. So we start with a lower evolution, governed by a cyclic, reactive or unconscious conditionality, and we develop by a spiral principle constituting creative, conscious action onto the higher evolution. If we accept this overall scheme, we can then break it up into stages. First, there is the subhuman stage of biological evolution. Then the specifically human stage starts with the point at which self-consciousness emerges. Following on from this, the higher evolution opens with the superhuman stage, characterized by the heroic individual or the genius. Finally, there is the stage starting from the point at which insight into the nature of reality is sustained at a sufficiently deep level to direct the individual's consciousness irreversibly towards enlightenment. This point is traditionally called stream entry, and it marks the beginning of what we may call the transhuman stage. We can, therefore, see what our general position is. People are at a wide range of levels of development between the human stage and the superhuman. As Buddhists, our agenda is to progress from wherever we are towards and through stage 3, the stage of heroism and genius. So this can be something of a surprise, that our path lies not in the direction of a slow attenuation of the self, of an abandonment of the self, but rather in the direction of a strong and heroic individuality. After all, if there is one thing that distinguishes the hero and the genius from comparatively ordinary people, it is their individuality. They are not units in a mass, they stand alone. One likes to think that one is an individual, but most of the time one is not. One may even try very hard to be different. One may try to look different, behave differently, behave outrageously indeed, but even this will not confer individuality on one, though it may in some cases be a start. We have to recognize that there is very little individuality about, because there is very little real awareness about, and that to become truly individual, we need to make a conscious effort to become more aware, to become more deeply aware of ourselves, more deeply aware of others, more deeply aware of the environment, of what is around us and more deeply aware of reality itself. Statistically, numerically, we may be individuals, but very, very few of us are individuals in a psychological and spiritual sense. Most people are simply not sufficiently aware to be classed as real individuals. So when Buddhists talk about going beyond the self and realizing the truth of non-self, they are talking about something that is quite out of the question for most of us. Most of us have not even developed a self yet, never mind realizing the non-self. If one has not developed a self that is distinguishable from a group mentality, if oneself is little more than an amorphous mass of conditionings, if one has not yet learned to be truly oneself, then nothing is really there to transcend. It is for this reason that the Buddhist path goes by way of the kind of ardent dedication and vision, the individuality, we find demonstrated by the great artist, the genius, and the hero. If we know who or what we mean by a hero or genius, we can get a clearer idea of what a stream entrant is, and even what it means to speak of a Buddha. We may say that the genius, the cutting edge of a culture, the cultural hero, represents to a greater or lesser degree what the average person can become from the point of view of cultural development. The stream entrant then represents what this kind of true individual can become spiritually, and the Buddha represents the goal towards which the stream entrant is irrevocably bound. They together constitute one continuous process of development within the higher evolution. We can thus begin to see an analogy, and perhaps not just an analogy but a real correspondence, between the cultural hero and the Buddha. The Buddha is the first historical example of what all men, all women, potentially are. The Buddha is different from other beings, not in kind, but in degree of development, in the degree to which he manifests his inner potentiality. In the scriptures, this crucial point is made by way of a typically homely image. Suppose, the Buddha says, a hen has laid a number of eggs, and suppose the hen sits on these eggs patiently until they start hatching. What happens then? Clearly, the chicks don't all hop out simultaneously. What happens is that one egg hatches first. So when this first chick emerges and stands clear of the eggshell, what does it do? It starts tapping with its little beak on the other shells, helping the other chicks out into the world. The meaning of this simile is not difficult to fathom. The egg is the state of unawareness, the womb of spiritual darkness and ignorance within which we sleep. The Buddha is the first chick, the first to break out of his shell, and having done so, he then rouses the others, tapping vigorously on their shells. Maybe he hears a muffled tapping coming back at him, and he taps more vigorously, to be answered again by a more eager tapping from within, until the shell cracks and a fellow chick hops out. Yet another of the Buddha's titles, therefore, is Loka Gyesta. The common translation, World Honoured One, does not give the full flavour of this term, because Gyeshta really means firstborn son, and is still used colloquially by the Nepalese in this sense. They tend to have a great many children, 10 or a dozen is quite common, and they usually address them as first son, second son, third son, etc., and likewise with the daughters. There's a special name for each: Jetta, first son, Kaila, second son, Mila, third son, etc. So, Loka, meaning world, Loka Gyesta, means the firstborn of the world, the elder brother of humanity, and it refers to the first human being to be spiritually reborn. This means that the only difference, spiritually speaking, between the Buddha and his enlightened disciples, the question is explicitly raised and answered in the scriptures, is that he attained enlightenment first, by himself, whereas they attained it subsequently with his help. In the scale of the higher evolution, the Buddha appears at the apogee, not a finite point, but, as it were, an infinite extension of the transhuman stage. He is neither human, strictly speaking, nor even superhuman, but simply fully enlightened. However, the higher evolution does not exclude the lower evolution. The Buddha is still human, still a man, only at the same time something more than that, something more even than a superman. But now what, you may ask, is this idea of the superman doing, coming into a discussion of the Buddha? Are we trying to interpret Buddhism along Nietzschean lines? In fact, there's no need to bring in Nietzsche here. The superman, or Mahapurusha, was evidently a quite important idea in India during the Buddha's lifetime, and an entire sutta, the Lakana Sutta, is devoted to a full description of this ideal figure. The characteristics, Lakana in Pali, of the Mahapurusha amount to 32 major marks or signs and 84 minor ones, and they quite clearly embody the highest aesthetic, cultural and religious ideals of the time. It would seem that the Buddha was regarded by his contemporaries as conforming to this ideal of the superman, which is really quite significant, because it shows that the Buddha did not bypass human perfection, even physical perfection, but incorporated it into the higher perfection of enlightenment. We like to distinguish human beings from animals, but in fact humanity does not exclude the animal. Our nature incorporates the animal in subordination to the truly human in us. We develop our humanity, all our truly human characteristics and functions, qualities and attitudes, not so much by rejecting the animal as by integrating the animal into the human. Therefore, just as human beings, even at the highest pitch of their development, include the animal in their makeup, so Buddhahood includes and integrates the human in subordination to the enlightened personality. The point to grasp from all this is that cultural attainment and spiritual development are strictly analogous, that they represent the lower and the higher levels of an overall spiritual process, the higher evolution. They are both the work of individuals in advance of and helping the rest of humanity. To get anywhere ourselves, then, we really do have to acknowledge that there are men and women who are more developed than we at present are. Hero worship, or the hero worshipping attitude, is by no means a bad thing, provided it is directed at the right objects. Provided, that is to say, it is directed towards those who are really more highly developed than the rest of us are, rather than towards the media-generated icons of contemporary popular culture. The tendency to cynicism, a determination to uncover the feet of clay, must be seen for what it is, a vice. That unwillingness to believe in anything like high ideals, to respect those who devote their lives to the serious pursuit of those ideals, or to recognize greatness in an individual, this whole attitude is soul-corroding and spiritually corrupt. By contrast, Buddhists try to cultivate a spirit of admiration, of respect, of reverence and devotion. This reverence is not only for certain individuals as they are, on account of the level of spiritual development they have already attained, but also for everybody else, on account of what they are capable of becoming. A comparison is drawn in the scriptures with the convention in a monarchical system of respecting the heir to the throne even as a baby. Though this child may be playing with his rattle now, you know that one day he's going to be king, and thus you treat him with the reverence due to a king. Buddhism encourages such an attitude, such a feeling, towards all sentient beings. They may be anything now. They may be thieves or prostitutes or financiers. They may even be politicians. But one day they are going to be Buddhas. However degraded their present condition, however limited their outlook, however enmeshed they are in their own evil deeds, you need to respect them on account of what they are in potentiality, which one day will surely be realized. No case is so desperate that you can ever say, "Oh well, they will never get out of the hell they have created for themselves." The classical villain of the Buddhist scriptures, for example, is Devadatta, the Buddha's cousin. In some ways he was one of the brightest of the Buddha's disciples. He had all sorts of psychic powers, but he was ambitious and jealous. One day he went to the Buddha and said, "Lord, you are getting old. Lord, don't exert yourself any more. Take it easy. Retire. I shall look after everything for you. I shall lead the Sangha." When the Buddha made it plain what he thought of this idea, Devadatta tried to initiate a split in the Sangha, which is regarded in Buddhism as a truly heinous crime. When this failed, he even made attempts upon the Buddha's life. He had a mad elephant let loose upon his teacher on one occasion, and another time he sent a boulder rolling down a hill towards him. All these attempts failed, of course, and sometime later Devadatta died of disappointment, and we're told that after his death he went to an unpleasant place. But the Mahayana scriptures tell us what Devadatta's name will be when he becomes a Buddha, and exactly when this will be. So whether or not you accept the precision of these forecasts, the principle is clear. Even someone like him has the seed of Buddhahood in him, and when he has purified himself, he too will become enlightened and liberate other sentient beings. No one, therefore, is ever completely and hopelessly lost. If Devadatta can bounce back, anyone can. Buddhists revere their spiritual teachers in particular, because their teachers represent what they can become, what they want to become, what indeed they will become when they have made the necessary effort. If we have no reverence for our ideals as embodied in the form of human beings, whether still alive or long dead, whether we meet them through personal contact or through the pages of a book, it will hardly be possible for us to attain that ideal for ourselves. Devotional practice, the whole question of worship in Buddhism, has to be understood as proceeding from this basis. This means that we have to dissociate the word worship from notions of church-going and the doxologizing of a universal creator figure. It is easy for people who associate religion exclusively with the worship of God to jump to the conclusion that if Buddhists worship, they must be worshipping a god. The confusion arises out of the limited sense in which the word worship is used nowadays. In India, by contrast, one word serves to denote the respect you pay to anyone, whether to the Buddha, your parents, your elder brothers and sisters, your teachers, spiritual and secular, or to any senior and honourable person. When Buddhists bow down and make offerings of flowers, candles and incense to the image of a Buddha or a Bodhisattva, they are honouring the Buddha as an enlightened being, not worshipping him as a god. Nor should this fact be allowed to suggest that worship plays a minor or even dispensable role in Buddhism, as those who present Buddhism as merely a rational philosophy would like to think. The expression of gratitude, of rejoicing, of respect, in short, worship, is fundamental to Buddhism. Just how fundamental becomes startlingly apparent when we take up again the account of the Buddha's life and found out what it was that occupied the Buddha's thoughts as he sat by the river Naranjara after his enlightenment. He remained in the same area for 7 weeks after attaining enlightenment, sitting beneath the trees, a few days beneath one tree, and then a few days beneath another. In this way the weeks passed by, and during this time he hardly bothered to eat. There's just one reference to food in the scriptural account. Apparently two wandering merchants offered him some honey and rice cakes, but we can assume that he was above all bodily considerations. It wasn't just that he'd gained enlightenment. That was a tremendous thing in itself. But it wasn't just that. He had something else to do, something which was, if anything, even more difficult. For 7 weeks he was intent upon the task of absorbing the enlightenment experience, allowing it to transform and transmute every atom and fibre of his being. After all, what had happened to him was literally the most tremendous thing that can possibly happen to a human being. The transformation from an unenlightened to an enlightened being is so overwhelming that in a sense when one becomes enlightened one ceases to be, in the ordinary sense, a human being at all. An enlightened human being, a Buddha, has entered an entirely new and different category of existence. The Buddha was the first in the course of human history to undergo this transformation. No wonder that he was staggered by his own achievement. And it seems that he found himself faced with one or two dilemmas. Or at least certain teachings have been presented in the form of dilemmas that exercised the newly awakened mind of the Buddha. One of them is quite well known and forms the basis for the next chapter. The other, which we're going to look at now, has been almost completely overlooked by commentators on the life of the Buddha. So far as I know, no one has remarked on the extraordinary and clear implications of the passage. Both episodes are found in the Samyutta Nikaya, the Book of the Kindred Sayings, that is, sayings of the Buddha on the same subject. But the first is found elsewhere in the Pali Canon as well. The more obscure, though as we shall see quite surprising, dilemma comes straight after the more famous one in the text, but it actually happened before it, having apparently occurred 5 weeks after the Enlightenment. The Buddha's reflections at this point, the quandary he was pondering, went as follows. It is ill to live paying no one the honour and obedience due to a superior. What recluse or Brahmin is there under whom I could live, paying him honour and respect? Now this is surely remarkable. The Buddha has just attained supreme enlightenment, and here we find him wondering to whom he can pay honour and respect. These days, of course, no one generally wants to pay honour and respect to anyone. We demand respect. We demand equality. We want to make sure that no one is regarded as superior to anyone else. Some of us may try to be polite and courteous, but the idea that respect benefits the person who offers it, rather than the person to whom it is offered, runs right against the grain of current social values. Not only that, the Buddha's attitude also seems to upset traditional Buddhist ideas about the Buddha and even about enlightenment itself. But let us continue with the episode. Perhaps things will become a little clearer. The Buddha continues to reflect, and his reflections are concerned with four things: the training in ethics, the training in meditation, the training in insight or wisdom, and the training in contemplation of knowledge of emancipation. What he sees is that there's no one in the universe, no one among the gods or even Brahma Sahampati, Lord of 1,000 worlds, and no human being, no holy or wise man anywhere, who is more accomplished in these things than he is himself. He sees that in terms of spiritual insight and understanding, he himself is the highest living being in the universe. This is how the Buddha sees himself. And if we don't see the Buddha in this way, then we don't really see the Buddha at all. Having realized for the first time who he really is, the Buddha sees that there is no one under whom he can live, paying him honor and respect. That surely is clear enough. One lives under someone in order to learn from them. As the Buddha is more highly developed than any other living being, he has nothing to learn, spiritually speaking, from anyone. But the crucial point here is that he doesn't give up. He still requires a focus for his devotion. So he reflects further. This Dharma, then, wherein I am supremely enlightened, what if I were to live under it, paying it honour and respect? And at this very moment, Brahma Sahampati appears before him and approves of the Buddha's decision, telling him that all the Buddhas of the past lived under the Dharma, honouring and respecting it, and that all the Buddhas of the future will do likewise. This is really an astonishing episode. It shows that even a Buddha needs, not that the enlightened mind can be literally in need of anything, to honour and respect something. Even a Buddha needs to offer worship. So worship is not just a spiritual practice to be taken up as a means to an end and then discarded once enlightenment is attained. Worship is an integral part of the enlightenment experience itself. The enlightened mind is a worshipping mind, no less than it is a realized mind or a compassionate mind. We are all familiar with the image of the meditating Buddha. We have probably seen images of the teaching Buddha, and even the standing or the walking Buddha. But we must add to these the much less familiar image of the worshipping Buddha. The text tells us that the object of the Buddha's devotion is the Dharma. Only it is not in this case the Dharma as we usually think of it. It is not the Dharma in the sense of the Buddha's teaching which the Buddha worships. For one thing, by the time of this particular episode, the Buddha had not as yet taught anybody anything. The Dharma referred to here is the Dharma as principle, the Dharma as the law, the truth, or reality. The Dharma we know about is the Dharma as just a conceptual formulation, expressed in accordance with people's needs, of the Dharma as reality itself. What the Buddha worships is the object or content of his own experience of enlightenment. When we think about it, however, a further difficulty confronts us here. If you worship something, what you worship is necessarily higher than you are. If the Buddha worships the Dharma, then the Dharma is higher than the Buddha. But in what sense can this be the case? Has not the Buddha penetrated the Dharma, mastered it, so to speak? What is left for him to worship in the Dharma? To solve this puzzle, we shall have to take another closer look at the most fundamental formulation of the Dharma, Praticca Samuppada, conditioned co-production, or dependent origination. As we saw in the first chapter, this principle consists in the fact that one thing is conditioned by something else, that whatever happens takes place by way of a cause. And conditioned co-production is of two kinds, one being a circular process, symbolized by the wheel of life, and the other generating a spiral of spiritual development. The first of these, the Buddha has clearly left behind him. He is free of the wheel of life. What we are concerned with at this point is Praticca Samuppada in its spiral form, the form of the successive stages of the spiritual path. The best known formulation of this sequence of positive mental states or experiences, known as the chain of positive nidanas, runs as follows. In dependence on suffering arises faith. In dependence on faith arises joy. In dependence on joy arises rapture. Independence on rapture arises calm. Independence on calm arises bliss. Independence on bliss arises concentration. Independence on concentration arises knowledge and vision of things as they really are. Independence on knowledge and vision of things as they really are arises dispassion. Independence on dispassion arises withdrawal or disentanglement. Independence on withdrawal or disentanglement arises freedom. Independence on freedom arises knowledge of the destruction of the ashravas, or all unskillful negative states. So this sequence is the second of the two processes by which the principle of Pratityasamutpada works out, and it represents the rationale of the spiritual life. In turn, it also divides into two sections, one mundane, the other transcendental. The first section consists of the first seven nidanas, or links, up to the arising of knowledge and vision of things as they really are. All these nidanas except the seventh are, though positive, though skillful, still mundane. They are mundane because after having attained them, you can still fall back to the wheel. From the arising of knowledge and vision of things as they really are onwards, however, through the five links that comprise the second section of the spiral, you cannot fall back, you can only go forward, and you cannot fall back from them because they are transcendental attainments. This makes the seventh nidana the crucial one. The arising of knowledge and vision of things as they really are marks the transition from the mundane to the transcendental. It constitutes the arising of transcendental insight, or stream entry. That is, the point at which you enter the stream that leads unerringly to the ocean of nirvana. It is also, for obvious reasons, known as the point of no return. So much for the 12 positive nidanas. The reason the whole matter of the nidana chain has been brought up is to clear up the mystery of how it is the Buddha worships the Dharma as higher than himself. The culmination of the nidana chain is the arising of knowledge of the destruction of the ashravas. This is what happens when one attains enlightenment. At this point, one becomes a Buddha. But is it literally the culmination? Is the 12th nidana literally the last one? To answer this question, we have only to turn to the scriptural account of the occasion when this nidana chain was originally delineated. We will find that it was put forward by the brilliantly gifted nun Dharmadina, whose exposition, we should add, the Buddha assented to in full. From what she said, it is clear that the formulation of the 12 positive nidanas stops at this point simply because it has to stop somewhere. So the implication is that there is no reason why the spiral process should not continue indefinitely. In other words, attaining enlightenment does not mean achieving a fixed determinate state, however high. It means becoming involved in an irreversible and unmeasured transcendental process. Therefore, even though the Buddha was the highest living being in the universe, even though he had progressed further along the spiral path than anyone else, there were still reaches of that path, there were still developments of that progression, which he had yet to explore. This is why it was possible for the Buddha to live under the Dharma, paying it honour and respect. The Dharma here is the law, or reality, of Pratityasamutpada. And for the worshipping Buddha, the Dharma is especially this law or reality as represented in unnamed and as yet unrealized nidanas. Nidanas which, from our point of view, are literally inconceivable. So this fact, that one of the first things the Buddha thinks of when he's gained enlightenment is to look for something to worship, and that even he is able to find something to worship, should be enough in itself to convince us of the central importance of worship within Buddhism. In this episode from the Samyutta Nikaya, the word for honour and respect is gaurava, which means, according to the dictionary, reverence, respect, honour, esteem, veneration, worship. So the term clearly suggests the kind of positive attitude which we naturally adopt towards something or someone we see or experience as being higher than ourselves. Obviously, there are the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, but is there anything else that can be an object of honour and respect? As it happens, the Buddhist tradition provides a list of 6 Gauravas, 6 objects that are worthy of reverence, respect and worship. They are Satta, Dharma, Sangha, Sikha, Appamada and Patisantara. The first 3 of these can be more or less taken as read. They are known collectively as the 3 jewels. The central act of becoming a Buddhist and of affirming one's commitment to Buddhism is traditionally termed going for refuge to the 3 jewels, usually abbreviated to just going for refuge. So you go for refuge to the Buddha as the ideal of enlightenment, to the Dharma as the fundamental spiritual principle discovered by him, together with their formulation in a body of teachings, and to the Arya Sangha as the spiritual community of those who really follow these teachings. In the context of the Gauravas, however, the first of the 3 jewels is termed Satta, which is yet another title accorded the Buddha, the full honorific usually being Satadeva Manusanang, teacher of gods and men. Why the term Satta appears here instead of Buddha is probably because we experience the Buddha through the scriptures mainly as teacher, as supreme teacher, the teacher of gods and men. Also to be considered is the fact that in ancient India, as in almost all ages apart from our own, anyone who earned the title of teacher automatically commanded great honour and reverence. It is still the case in India today. You call even your primary school teacher your guru, and it is of course a term of great respect. In the Buddhist tradition, parents are often called the first gurus, or to use another term with an equivalent meaning, the first acharyas, because they are the first people from whom you learn anything. And again, this represents a posture of respect. You respect your parents, not only because they brought you into the world, but also because they were the first people from whom you learnt anything. The remaining 3 Gauravas after Satta, Dharma and Sangha are less familiar. The fourth, Sikha, is study, training or discipline. Study is a Gaurava inasmuch as we cannot study Buddhism effectively unless we see it as something higher than we are, as having the power to help us to grow and develop, just as the rain and sunshine help plants and trees to grow. In Buddhism, there are traditionally 3 objects of study or training: the higher ethics, the higher states of consciousness, and the higher wisdom. These are the preeminent sources from which we learn, grow and develop. But there are all sorts of other things that benefit our human development. Friendship and the fine arts, for example. And these too can be aspects of Buddhist study and training, and thus worthy of honour and respect. Thus the basic principle implied by the idea of study as a Gaurava is that if we are unable to honour and respect something, it isn't really worth studying because it won't help us. The fifth Gaurava is Appamada, or non-heedlessness, that is, mindfulness or awareness. So, why is mindfulness to be venerated? Why is it one of the 6 Gauravas? The answer is quite simple. We have to respect those qualities which we are trying to develop. If we think rather lightly of them, if we don't really take them seriously, we won't get anywhere with them. In other words, it behoves us to bring an attitude of reverence to our own spiritual practice, whether it be mindfulness or indeed any other discipline that we are taking up. Appamada, or non-heedlessness, is named as the 5th Gaurava in an essentially representative sense, in the sense of being pivotal, the key to all other Buddhist practice. With the last of the Gauravas, we are introduced to a rather interesting word with a wide range of associated meanings, Patisantara. It comes from a root meaning to spread, and its literal meaning is spreading before. This probably leaves us none the wiser, so far as identifying it as an object of respect is concerned. However, there is an English idiom that takes us a little closer to the nature of this Gaurava. laying out a good spread. It's an old-fashioned expression, redolent of tuck boxes and midnight feasts in the dormitory with one's chums, or high tea with an indulgent great aunt, but you get the idea. A spread is a sort of feast, and Patti Santara has much the same kind of meaning. It means spreading before, in the sense of friendly welcome, kind reception, honour, goodwill, favour, friendship. This is what the dictionary tells us. And the spreading before can be material or it can be spiritual. If you take it as meaning a kind reception, you can see that as well as gastronomic feasting, it could suggest a feast, say, of music, and even the feast of reason and the flow of soul. At the highest level, it's a spreading of spiritual abundance before people. Thus, Patti Santara covers a rich, important aspect of human life, including spiritual life, and we will not be able to draw nourishment from it if we take it for granted. As well as honouring mindfulness, the heart of Buddhist practice, we also need to honour the whole expansive richness of the Buddhist life. The significance, place of reverence and worship in the spiritual life is made explicit in the teaching of the six Gauravas. But as we have seen, it is clear from the evidence of the Buddha's own life too, that worship is a spiritual requirement of every Buddhist, however highly developed. In fact, the greater the place we can give to worship in our own lives, the more certain we can be of one day attaining to whatever the Buddha himself attained, and of worshipping as the Buddha himself worshipped.